loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Israel mobilized troops and carried out airstrikes in Gaza today, and President Trump signed a proclamation recognizing Israeli control of the occupied Golan region of Syria. Next, desperate attempts to avert a no-deal Brexit are underway in the UK Parliament. Then, we continue our regular segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers. And finally, we have our regular segment, Technology Rules, with Chris Garaffa.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Celebrity lawyer Michael Avenatti was arrested today and charged with extortion. He allegedly attempted to coerce Nike into giving him $20 million in exchange for not releasing damaging information about the company. Avenatti has inserted himself into national politics in recent years by representing Stormy Daniels in her case against Donald Trump. Mike Pence denounced Democrats who are skipping AIPAC's annual conference, a high-profile event that regularly draws the highest-ranking politicians in the country. This year, many candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination are skipping the conference in response to a grassroots campaign launched in response to the Islamophobic attacks on Representative Ilhan Omar. Pence said, quote, "Anyone who aspires to the highest office in the land should not be afraid to stand with the strongest supporters of Israel in America." A fourth Kurdish prisoner being held in Turkey committed suicide, according to officials from the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party. Prisoner Medya Çınar hanged herself to protest the conditions of jailed Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan. A hunger strike started 140 days ago in protest of these conditions, and three other prisoners killed themselves in that time span. The head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, Elhaj Asi, said, quote, "We are sitting on a ticking time bomb," unquote, a waterborne disease in the area of southeastern Africa that was hit by Cyclone Idai on March 15th. These include cholera, typhus, and malaria. Humanitarian aid right now is focused on food, shelter, and temporary infrastructure repairs. U.S. Envoy to North Korea Stephen Biegun is in Beijing for talks aimed at reinvigorating the negotiations between the U.S. and the DPRK. Biegun arrived in China yesterday. The peace process has been in jeopardy since the failure of the Hanoi summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Israel and Palestine. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with President Trump in Washington today for a ceremony in which the U.S. formally recognized Israeli's sovereignty over the Golan region of Syria. The visit is being cut short, however, because a rocket fired from Gaza hit an Israeli house in Tel Aviv, injuring seven people. Sensing yet another opportunity to present himself as a hardliner ahead of the April 9th election, Netanyahu ordered the mobilization of ground units, and the Israeli Air Force has begun launching a wave of airstrikes against Gaza. We're joined from Amman, Jordan, by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. His latest book is Sesame Street Palestine, The Ups and Downs of Producing a Children's Program. Welcome back, Daoud.
Thank you very much.
Daoud, one of the things that has struck me about this American announcement is how little reaction we've seen from the Arab countries of the Middle East. I've been following these issues since I was a teenager, right? All through college, all through my career at the CIA, at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This is such a major change of a half century plus of American policy. Why is there not more anger coming from the Middle East?
You're right. There isn't enough anger from the Middle East. But one of the problems is that Syria is a divided country, and the Arab world is divided around Syria. And so the whole idea of a sovereign Syria is now a joke, because Syria is not a sovereign country. It's divided between different factions, different groups, different external forces and internal forces. So I think the problem is, and the kind of the smartness of this move, is that it has come at a time when sovereignty of Syria itself is in question. And I think that's one of the reasons why the response has not been as loud as you'd expect. I think the Arab League is meeting in the next week or so, and I'm sure they will issue a very strong statement on this issue.
I'm wondering, too, what the reaction is going to be inside Palestine. Are Gazans or West Bank Palestinians focused on the Golan, or is this seen as an issue that doesn't impact their daily lives and they're worried about their own day-to-day survival?
And I want Dawood to comment on that because that's seriously important. But, you know, let's just ask Dawood this too. Is this a political favor to Benjamin Netanyahu? On the eve of the elections, right, from Donald Trump? Is that him?
Is this what saves Netanyahu?
Of course. You know, Purim is a kind of a Halloween type of a holiday in Israel, and I think this is totally a kind of a Christmas gift time where the Israeli prime minister is being given gifts so that he can win the next election. I think it's a kind of a very exposed type of a gift-giving where the foreign policy of the U.S. is being decided by tweets. Even the Secretary of State didn't know about it, and they certainly haven't thought enough through it. I mean, they're opposed to Crimea, and now they're recognizing another occupied area, which is in a violation of UN Security Council 242. But for Palestinians, you know, Israel annexed the Golan Heights a long time ago, and so the real problem is Israeli policy, not the U.S. policy. The U.S. policy, everybody understands it, is being giving gifts to the Israelis, but it will not change the situation on the ground much. And most Israeli officials have negotiated with Syria after they annexed Gaza about giving back most of the Golan Heights. And I'm sure this will happen one day. And so it doesn't really matter that much, the U.S. recognition. It's a political gift to Netanyahu, but it doesn't really change much on the ground.
It shows a lot about Israeli politics that this would be the gift to Netanyahu. He's beset by criminal probes. He has an opposition. Look, perhaps earlier, like he might even lose. But you have Donald Trump announcing, look, Jerusalem is going to be the capital of Israel and thus the place where the U.S. embassy will set up. That's in violation of international law.
Yes.
Completely.
Yeah, but, you know that God sent Trump to save the Jews. I mean, that's what Pompeo is saying. I mean, so ridiculous. We're trying to keep religion out of our region, and now we don't have enough problems with fundamental Islam, fundamental Jews. Now we have to deal with fundamentalist Christians. Come on. I mean, keep the religion out of our conflict. We have enough religious fervor and extremists to add to it the U.S. American kind of Christian Zionism. I was so upset with that statement.
What Dawood is talking about, John, is that Mike Pompeo went to Israel, basically, to represent evangelical Christian Zionists.
That's exactly what he did.
And, like, going and, like, this is part of the great, you know, Christian view of the new coming of the Jewish Messiah. I mean, he's right about that. And at the same time, the point I was making is that the decision on Jerusalem, now the decision to give these stolen territories, Golan Heights is part of Syria, to Israel.
Stolen territories, which the entire rest of the world recognizes as having been stolen.
Yeah, in a war in 1973.
And just today, the EU has said, we still don't accept the annexation. It is occupied territory and it must be returned to Germany. Today, the EU, the European Union, America's biggest ally in the world, is also rejecting Netanyahu and Trump's kind of game. It's so, so sick that international politics has become such a cheap game of, you know, doing favors to one another.
Yeah, and there are resolutions going back to 1967 when, during the war in June 1967, Israel seized part of Egypt, it seized the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights. Now, Golan Heights is part of Syria. But I think the point that Dawood was making earlier, the muted response within the Middle East, is one because Syria is divided. So, and people just, it's sort of a de facto a division. And also because Israel already has the Golan Heights, that this is really a political message from the Trump administration to Netanyahu, his buddy, who's in trouble politically. Look, no matter what you do, no matter what problem you have, we're gonna let you go home and show to the right wing, increasingly racist, expansionist Israeli political body, you can deliver the goods with Washington.
It's so sick. I just can't. International law, international legitimacy, the world order is falling apart because some narcissist, racist guy wants to do favors to his buddies. It's just so sickening.
That's really what it comes down to. Well, we'll leave it there. We were happy to be joined from Amman, Jordan, by Dawood Qutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist, and his latest book is called Sesame Street Palestine, The Ups and Downs of Producing a Children's Program. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British members of Parliament began debating a series of alternatives today to Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan with an eye toward holding a third vote on the deal. The Prime Minister met with her cabinet at No. 10 Downing Street this morning, where reports say she was confronted over her inability to unify her party. Meanwhile, a petition calling for a new referendum on Brexit has now gathered more than 5 million signatures. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Delighted to be with you again.
Alexander, walk us through the Prime Minister's day today. She had an early morning cabinet meeting. British media is reporting that that fully half of her cabinet thinks that that she's headed down the road to disaster. There are at least three other Tory party members who are vying to become Prime Minister in the case that she fails here. What are we looking at this week?
Before we actually deal with today, it's important to say that yesterday she had emergency meetings with the strong supporters of Brexit within her own party. She had this conference in which she brought all these people, Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Dominic Raab, David Davis, all these extraordinary people that we've probably been hearing lots about. And she tried to get them to back her agreement when it comes up for a vote on Tuesday. Apparently they refused, and they said to her that rather than that, the only chance she had of getting them to agree to that would be if she agreed to resign. She refused to do that, it seems. So it is, they're all going to vote against her on Tuesday. It seems that the Democratic Unionists, this is the Northern Irish Protestant Party that she relies upon to have a majority, they're all going to vote against her also. The Labour Party will vote against her. And, of course, the other Remain parties, pro-Remain parties, the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Nationalists, all those, they're going to vote against her also. So unless something very unexpected happens, she's going down to another big defeat on this same proposal that she's put to the House of Commons on two previous occasions. This will be the third time that she's brought it, and it's the third time it will fail. Now, in the meantime, in parallel to these moves, and possibly as an attempt to put pressure on the hardline Brexiters within her own party, she's holding today in Parliament, or she's discussing holding, what are called indicative votes. These are a series of informal votes. They have no legal weight, but in which various members of Parliament are asked to propose various solutions to the Brexit crisis. The House of Commons votes on each of them, and that will supposedly show which of those options has the greatest support. Now, amongst those options, there is the soft Brexit option, which is a Britain remaining in the customs union and the single market, aligned very closely economically with the EU. Another is a second referendum. A third is revoking Article 50, that is to say, cancelling Brexit entirely. So that's her idea, but it's important to stress that these indicative votes have no legal force. But then there is another proposal which is being suggested by some opposition MPs, but which appears to have some support from the Conservative Party, from strong Remainers within the Conservative Party, which is that they're apparently mooting the idea of proposing a vote which might have legal force, but nobody knows, seems to know for certain, whereby if Theresa May can't negotiate Brexit with the Europeans, then a committee of the House of Commons will do so independently of her. That would be a huge shift in the constitutional position in Britain, which has always treated the government as the sole institution competent to negotiate with outside powers, foreign powers. That would create, in effect, a dual power situation in Britain of a sort that we've never had before. And we will see whether that succeeds, and we will see what kind of legal weight it has if it does. But the indications at the moment are that Theresa May will probably ignore it.
All right. That's Alexander Mercouris. We're talking to Alexander from London. I was there in Brussels covering the summit John, as you know, on Thursday and Friday. Clearly, after she was unable to convince the EU that they should give her a June 30th extension because they said, well, what if you fail again and she didn't have a plan B? They took control of the process and they said, okay, March 29th is now April 12th. But it's not a cliff edge, meaning if you fail to pass the resolution in the House of Commons, it doesn't mean automatically that Britain leaves the EU without a deal, that you can come back and have until April 12th to make a new deal, to make right. a new suggestion about a way forward. Alexander, given everything, given what you just told us and what the options are, a soft Brexit as a permanent customs union, a second referendum, revoking Article 50, or a parliamentary committee replacing the prime minister as the interlocutor with the EU, which is the more likely of these, or is there something else that we're not seeing?
It's very, very, very difficult to say at the moment because, of course, what has happened with the whole Brexit process is that it's now become a crisis within the Conservative Party and within the Conservative government because the majority of members of the Conservative Party and the majority of the voters who vote Conservative in Britain clearly want a Brexit, and they would probably want a hard no-deal Brexit, this thing that we've been hearing so much about. But there is no majority for a no-deal Brexit in the House of Commons. My own view is that if Theresa May and the government, the Conservative government, were to decide to go for a no-deal Brexit, then regardless of what the House of Commons voted or said, that is probably what would happen on the 12th of April. The big question is whether the anti-Brexit MPs and ministers within the Conservative government are able to push back strongly enough against that idea in order to block it, and what sort of proposal they would be able to come up with. I say that because the classic solution in Britain to a problem, a kind of crisis that we have at the moment, would be a change, a general election and a change of government. And I think if that were to happen, I think the Europeans would agree to extend the timetable by, say, 6 weeks to a month that would be needed for a new government to take office.
Just a quick follow-up there. There's EU parliamentary elections coming up on May 23rd. Right now, Britain won't be participating, but with an extension, it would be mandatory that they would. And then those British EU parliamentarians would be serving a 2-year term. Again, is that likely?
It's an absolute legal nightmare because, of course, from the point of view of the EU, and you're absolutely right, by the way, in what you said, that it's the EU that has now taken control of the timetable. From the EU's point of view, the very last thing they want to see is the British participating in European parliamentary elections, voting MPs to the European Parliament, and then at some point leaving the EU entirely. I mean, that is a legal nightmare, and it doesn't make any kind of sense for them. So what they want to see is either Britain leave, you know, preferably before those European elections take place, or the British come forward and say, look, this thing has been so badly handled, we've got to start all over again with the whole negotiations. So we are going to participate in the European elections on the basis that we're going to be staying in the EU for at least, you know, 1 or 2 years, so that those MPs that we elect will actually have something meaningful to do. Now, that, of course, depends very much on the British coming forward to the Europeans before the 12th of April with some coherent plan. And at the moment, they don't have one. So looking at this on the other side, from the European side, this particular moment in time, it's not obvious why they would agree to a further extension beyond the 12th of April.
I agree with you. And I think you could see, even though they don't want, the EU doesn't want Britain to leave, and they don't want them to leave without a deal, but they're prepared to have Britain leave without a deal because it can't keep going and going. Anyway, that's what I think you're saying. Alexander, we have 10 seconds left.
I think, as I said, it's a crisis now in Britain. And what I would simply say is the British voted to take back control in the 2016 election, and they've lost it.
the people who have control over the process and are going to make the final decisions are the European Council. So far from taking back control, the British have less control than ever.
John, we're gonna follow this story tomorrow, every day this week. Okay.
That's right. Well, we were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of many books, including You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Nice to hear your voices. Good to be here.
Bill, one of my best friends in the world lives in Lower Manhattan and has one child. He wanted, of course, like any parent, his child to have the best possible education, and he decided to go the private school route. So he got her into a school in Chinatown that turned out to be terrible, and the poor girl's now 11 years old and can read Chinese because it's a Chinese school, but she can't read English very well and just is getting a lousy all-around education. That story is not unique in big cities like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles. There are a lot of bad schools, but there are a lot of good selective high schools that are very competitive, that you have to really work hard to get into. It's
public
like getting
schools.
Into a college, public schools.
Yeah.
Let's talk for a minute about New York high schools and the selective admissions process for some of these schools and why so many students are left out in the cold and are just simply not able to get a good education.
Yeah, let me start back where you started and say, you know, I have nothing but respect for parents who are fighting for a decent education for their kids. I mean, your child is only 6 for 1 year and only 8 for 1 year. So the struggle of parents to get a good education often goes, you know, south because we don't have great, great choices sometimes. But I never want to blame the parents for seeking something out, whether it's charters or, you know, moving to the suburbs or whatever they can do, because they're desperate and the choices on offer aren't that great. But the larger question you raise, I've been obsessing about this for a couple of weeks since the big scandal broke about the ultra wealthy bribing their ways into the University of Southern California and Harvard. And we've talked about this a bit in the past. We've talked about the ways in which they're set up to, you know, I found out, for example, this week that this year's class, freshman class at Harvard, 30% of those accepted were legacies. So your best chance of getting into Harvard is to choose parents who went to Harvard. I mean, it's so absurd that it kind of boggles your imagination. But let's go back to New York City high schools. I mean, Bronx Science and Stuyvesant High School are two of the, you know, nationally known, internationally known, great, great schools. But what makes them great? And one of the things we have to note and focus on and talk about is that what makes them great is they have a policy of exclusion. In other words, their prestige rides on exclusion. Stuyvesant accepts 4% of the students who take a test. Now imagine being among the 96%. You know, you've staked a lot on getting into this fantastic high school. If you get into it, you're going to go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton or Columbia. And you've put so much into it, and now you're a loser. I mean, what can that possibly do to you, to your parents, to your family? And why is it the case? So I think we need to note that the algorithms they use and so on are, and what gives them their status is exclusion, not inclusion, exclusion. I think that's an important place to begin.
Yeah, where I'm looking at the New York Times and the Washington Post have also, there's done articles on this, and there's a lot of different sides to it. What Bill is pointing out that when you have a system where 96% of the kids who are, you know, hardworking, high-achieving kids don't make it, are, quote, losers, and I'm using air quotes, it reinforces lots of different feelings that are not positive. Why did I do all this work? Or, you know, is there something wrong with me? There's a lot of blowback or possible blowback within families. And then there's the issues of who are those 4% and how did they make it? And the Washington Post article, I'm looking at it, seven out of 895, the number of black students admitted to New York City's most selective high school. And there are more startling stats. Again, the same story we're following here, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, now that should be a condemnation of us as a society, of the New York City public schools as a system. That should be a condemnation of the fact that these kids show up to take the tests and they've gone through schools where they can't make the grade. I mean, that's a condemnation of the schools, but we don't see it that way. We continue to have this kind of basic position that the problem is somehow inside the kids. But that is absolutely absurd and preposterous. It's not true. So what we have is a broken system, and the system likes to pat itself on the back for having a school like Stuyvesant. I was talking to one of my graduate students over the weekend, and she had a daughter who tested into an exclusive elementary public school in Chicago, and she was put on the wait list. And my student said, what is this? You know, that she tests in, she passes the test, but they only have X number of seats and it's a zero sum game. You get in, you're great. You don't get in, you're going to get a crappy education. What kind of a system does that? And frankly, the answer is a capitalist system. And that's the system of education we have. It produces a few winners and a ton of losers. One of the statistics that jumped out at me was the idea that if every kid accepted into Stuyvesant, every kid was black or Latinx or of poverty from a community of poverty, if every kid accepted were black or Latin, you would still have tens of thousands of kids who were not getting a decent education because of the zero-sum game that the New York City public schools and the Chicago public schools, and frankly, our entire system is. That is an outrage. And we've been talking on this show a lot about the fact that we need to stand up and defend public education. But as we do that, remember, we're not defending the status quo. We're defending an idea that is precious but fragile. And that idea is that every kid, as a matter of rights, has the ability to go to a decent, forward-looking, fully funded, intellectually grounded school. And we are so far from that that it's staggering. And this college admission scandal and now all the attention put onto Stuyvesant and Bronx Science should bring us to that, should make us recognize that we have a system that's badly broken. And even at its best, if you took every kid and, well, look, imagine this, if you took every black and Latin kid took a position in the Ivy Leagues, that would mean something like 60,000 kids would be getting this great education, and millions of kids would be failing to get that great education. That is an abomination in a democracy, and it's something we should highlight and struggle against.
Yeah, good points. Excellent points. Matter of fact, the points, because yes, we're struggling for affirmative action. That's an imperative need to overcome and undo or rectify or remedy or mitigate the, you know, centuries of racism and discrimination. But real equality means equality, not just for the top, who gets in at the very, very top. It's really like turning this pyramid, which the capitalist society is, turning it upside down, instead of the majority doing, you know, basically all the work and all the benefits accruing to the top, make it really equal. Bill Ayers, 30 seconds left. Go ahead, take us out.
You raised the question of affirmative action. I think we should note that if 30% of the kids getting into Harvard are legacies, that's affirmative action for the wealthy. That is an affirmative statement for the wealthy. And this is what the system looks like writ large. I'd like to talk in the future about how these rankings are done and how schools like Stuyvesant and MIT and Harvard get ranked the way they do, because that also is deeply fraudulent. What we need is a school system in which every kid has access to a decent education. It's within our grasp. It's politically very difficult.
Okay, we will leave it there. That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joined us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of many books, including You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa, and we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, guys.
Happy to be here.
Same. Happy to be here.
Chris, the news has been full of great, interesting information lately on Michael Cohen, and mostly whether or not Michael Cohen's a good guy or a bad guy. But there was a piece on ABC News Go that I thought was very interesting, and it was about how the FBI tracked Michael Cohen's phones. They used a device called a triggerfish. What is that?
So a triggerfish is a family of devices. You might have heard more commonly a stingray or a hailstorm. These are small devices about the size of a package, a suitcase, that basically let police and law enforcement intercept and track all cellular signals in an area. They basically pretend to be a cell phone tower. And by being a cell phone tower, they're able to get information about every cell phone that connects to it. You know, your phone, this is the way it should work, right? Your phone connects to the strongest signal it has. That's the closest tower in most cases. But these devices pretend to be a cell phone tower. Sometimes they pass through your signal, so you can't even tell that there's a triggerfish or stingray device in the middle, but they let the law enforcement analyze all the traffic coming through. So this story that came out, it was actually released, the information was released Tuesday because of the search warrant documents that the FBI had were released. They said they used this triggerfish to track Cohen's two iPhones to a pair of rooms a floor apart at a Manhattan hotel. So that's one of the most shocking things. And another thing that this article mentions, and it's just one paragraph in here, is that the agency also obtained logs of who he was calling, who he was texting, and they say, quote, reams of location data. And that's just, you know, one paragraph in this article, but I think that's also a very significant thing for folks to know. I'm not going to comment on, you know, this particular case, you know, the details of it, but people should be aware that this is not something that is just used in the most high-profile cases. There has been evidence of police and federal agencies using a stingray-type device at mass protests, particularly in New York City. They also use these on what they say are gang-related investigations. But of course, you know, they can't just pick a few phones. They have to pick up, by the way this works, they're picking up every single phone that connects to that tower, because that's, again, how cell phones are supposed to work.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk all the time about constitutionality on this show. How that's constitutional without probable cause to just vacuum up everybody's cell phone data. It's a mystery to me.
Yeah, I actually pulled up the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution while Chris was talking because, I mean, it's such an obvious violation of mm-hmm. it. So, I mean, this is what the Fourth Amendment says. So, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So, I mean, in other words, searches can only be searches and seizures, right? So seizures of data counts. It's, you know, 2019. Can only be done when there's one, probable cause, and two, you know, it's very specific, right? You know, you can search this thing for this reason and take this, you know, very particular thing that's related to, you know, some kind of crime that you have probable cause to think, you know, someone's involved in. But what you're saying, Chris, is that this device, right, the triggerfish and other surveillance mechanisms in that family of technology are completely arbitrary. It just sort of sucks up, you know, attracts all of the cell phone signals in a geographic area without discrimination as to who that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad, Walter, that you brought up the Fourth Amendment. People think it often, you know, sounds antiquated. You know, what does documents mean? I think documents certainly would apply to all of our, you know, technology that we have today. you know, and I'm like I said, I'm glad you brought that up. Every technology and security training I do, I start with a slide containing the Fourth Amendment, and I read it out loud to the group to make sure that they understand that these are their rights. These are the rights that they have in the United States, no matter who they are, and they are being violated by the government every day. I also want to mention, by the way, that Michael Cohen was forced to unlock his phone using either his face with, you know, the Face ID technology or his fingerprint using, you know, the Touch ID style technology. It's not clear which one they were able to use, but they got permission. The government got permission to force him to do that, which has been, for the most part, you know, the case, you know, effective case law, you know, unfortunately. There are some moves to, you know, where that could be changing, but right now, if you're concerned about law enforcement getting into your phone, use a PIN, a passcode, rather than your, Touch ID or Face ID.
You know, let me ask you, too, about that. I don't want to get too far afield on this issue, but I think this is important. We have Enright, Colonel Enright, on our show with some frequency. Ann is a former State Department diplomat. She's an Army colonel, retired Army colonel. She's a peace activist and member of Code Pink. She and Medea Benjamin and several of our other friends returned recently from Iran. And when they arrived at Dulles Airport, she was told by Immigration and Customs Enforcement to turn over her iPhone and to unlock it. Now, there was no probable cause. She had not been charged with a crime. But she was told that if she did not turn over her phone and unlock it, they would take the phone and she would not get it back. What do you make of that? Now, with Michael Cohen, I understand the guy's under indictment, he's under investigation, they're preparing to charge him with multiple felonies. I got it. But Ann Wright, because they didn't like the place where she happened to travel?
That's, you know, very clear harassment. I'm not surprised, unfortunately, to hear that. But it's very clear harassment of a peace activist. And people should be aware, if you're involved in activist movements, that can happen to you, not just traveling internationally. But remember that DHS, Customs and Border Patrol, consider the border to extend 100 miles inland from the United States. So they can board a bus or a train. You know, if I got on a train here in New Haven to go to Boston, for example, that can be considered a border zone. And they can ask you to hand over your phone, to unlock it and whatnot. Now, it's important to note, and I certainly hope that that Ann Wright knew this, and I'm sure she did, you cannot be compelled to unlock your phone in that sense, in that situation. But especially if you're an American citizen with an American passport coming back into the country, but they can make it really difficult for you to go through the process, and you'd have to get, you know, a lawyer involved. They can only hold you for so long, but they're going to threaten you. They're going to make it as uncomfortable for you as they possibly can to get you to give in to their demands.
That's a terrible thing.
There's a related story that you flagged for us about what Nevada police are doing. Tell us a little bit about the scanning technology that's used in that instance.
Sure. So there's a proposal in Nevada to allow state police to actually check out your cell phone to see if you were texting right before an automobile accident. So first of all, we should say you don't use your cell phone while you're driving. Like, it can wait. But This would be another dangerous precedent to set if Nevada passes this law. They're calling it the textilizer, right? It connects to the phone and it looks for activity, like was Facebook Messenger open? Were you texting? Were you looking at another app? And there's no information about how this information would be stored, how it would be used. They clearly would save it because they're going to try to use it in, you know, either for the insurance companies or in a court case against you. So it would have to be saved, right? This would be, you know, evidence of something, right? Of a potential crime being occurred. The other interesting thing to this story to me was this technology is created by an Israeli company called Cellebrite, who makes other devices that law enforcement use to try to break into phones. That's what this company does. They make devices that law enforcement plug phones into to make copies, to try to break the encryption on them. These are very, very expensive devices. And so there's, you know, serious concerns about this technology. Unfortunately, if Nevada implements it, that could mean that, you know, other states around the country feel like that's a go-ahead to implement it. But let's go back to the Fourth Amendment. You know, this also seems like it is a violation.
Yeah. Let's move on to something that we talked about last week, too, Chris. This is really an outrage, I think. But this is airplane seat cameras. Now, this is the notion that those little screens that we watch movies on in airplanes, they have cameras. And those cameras are looking at us. What's up with that?
Yeah, I mean, air travel is already, you know, a pain. It's already, you know, just a hassle, and no one likes it unless you're spending thousands of dollars for clear and first, you know, first class. But now we find out that some airlines and some airplanes are fitted with cameras in each seat above that little screen that you watch your movies on or you play games on. You know, we talked a few weeks ago, right, about Google having a microphone that no one knew about in their Nest.
Right.
And, you know, the connection I make here is Google says, oh, we weren't using it. You know, we could potentially turn it on later. Well, the airlines are also saying that these cameras are not turned on and they haven't had plans to turn them on. But, like, then why are they there? Why aren't they just covered up? Right. The connection, you know, too, that I'm making here with privacy is not just the airplane, you know, the Boeing or your airline monitoring you while you're in your seat, which is just creepy. But it's also, you know, Homeland Security getting access to those feeds. We already know that in airports, Homeland Security has, you know, cameras everywhere. They're doing facial recognition, and they also use some, you know, sort of human intelligence style analysis too, right? So they have agents watching how people are walking. Do you look nervous? And I mean, really, who doesn't look nervous or tired when they're trying to get through security and go to the gate and squeeze into that little seat, right? Like, you know, and they can pull you aside for another, you know, another search of your bag. I mean, it's happened to me before, just going on vacation, right? I was exhausted and they pulled me aside. So, you know, but they watch all of these things. They have agents watching either directly there or on camera in the airport, and they can pull you aside for additional questioning or additional searches. So there's no evidence, we should say, that they're going to use it for this, but I don't think it's a stretch to say that that's, you know, not a next step, knowing that there are cameras in these to watch how somebody's behaving, you know, in their seat on an airplane.
You know, let me add something, too. I'm harassed constantly every time I come back into the United States. Constantly. Like, not a single time goes by that I'm not pulled into secondary. Sometimes I'm made to sit for as long as 4 hours in secondary. I just sit there and I'll write an op-ed on my phone just to keep myself busy. But you are within your rights to say, I'm not going to answer any questions without the benefit of counsel. You can say that because they're going to screw you anyway. They're going to make you sit there all day anywhere. But the bottom line is, they cannot stop you from re-entering your own country, right?
Is there a time limit for that?
There's not, but eventually they're going to give up. They're going to give up because it becomes harassment at some point, and that point is up to a judge, and they just don't need the headache. So eventually they're just going to let you go. I can't tell you how many times I have told these knuckleheads who man the Customs and Border Protection booth or whatever it is, immigration or whatever they call themselves today. Look, I'm represented by counsel and I'm not going to answer any of your questions. You're perfectly free to Google me if you want. That will probably answer your questions, but I'm not talking to you. And eventually they give up and they let you go.
Yeah, that's good to know. I mean, I'm also thinking about, you know, how could this be used by airlines, you know, these cameras, which,
oh,
you know,
totally.
They allege are not, you know, being used for anything nefarious or maybe not being used at all. But I was also thinking about, like, the possible, like, commercial money-making applications of this. Like, it probably is valuable for them to know, for instance, you know, how long on average does one of their customers spend sleeping on a flight? Or, you know, how often on average do their customers, you know, read books or on their phones or, you know, working on their computers, you know, just sort of monitoring that type of, like, activity that people are doing. I bet there's a way to monetize that. What do you think, Chris?
Oh, there certainly is a way to monetize that. And, you know, I think they could say, oh, if people are sleeping or just sitting there reading, maybe they don't need as much space. But if their people are using their laptops, they could sell a new laptop class seat, right? With maybe a little more space on the tray table. You know, there's infinite ways that they could think of to monetize this information, certainly.
Let's move on then to the next one before we get too depressed talking about that one. And this is about Google. Google knows where you live, work, and your secret interests, new shadow profile report says. Chris, I'm a big fan of... Well, before I got in trouble with the feds, I was a big fan of Law and Order. And I remember when the internet was first sort of invented and offered to regular Joes like you and me, I remember Sam Waterston, who's one of the stars of that show, being confused as to exactly what the internet was. And his assistant went into the office the next day and said that she had done a search on him, and she told him his birth date, she told him his address, she told him where he went to school and what he got a degree in. And then I still remember she said, "You have an odd obsession with The Clash." And he was shocked that she could find that kind of information on him. Now, this was probably 1993 or whatever it was. Here we are in 2019. What's this article about?
Sure. So, you know, he probably would have been at that point posting on a forum or message board about, you know, dedicated to The Clash, right? But what we're talking about here is not just somebody's birthday and their interests that they've expressed online, but where they go. This is, you know, talking about, this is a document we should mention that was submitted by Oracle, which is another tech giant, in a lawsuit against Google in Australia. They're trying to get Australia to rule that Google should be broken up, which, you know, we talked about last week, and that's all sorts of problematic itself. But they're saying that Google is doing micro-target advertising. So basically, if you connect, the example that Oracle gives, if you connect to the same Wi-Fi network from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, they can probably guess that that's where you work. Or if you connect to the same one, if they say every day at 7 p.m. and you stay connected all night, that's probably your home, even if you haven't given Google your home address. But they can also do this by, you know, to figure out where you're shopping. So if they go around and, you know, you're regularly on Saturday afternoons, you do your grocery shopping at, you know, a Stop and Shop store, they can figure out that this is the one you normally go to and you normally go at this time. And so, you know, when Stop and Shop wants to sell ads, they can actually target specifically to people who come in on Saturday afternoons.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah. They're taking all of this location data. And we should mention that when you are using, and this is true for Apple Maps and Google Maps on your phones, by the way, one of the reasons that they often tell you, you ever get that pop-up, turn Wi-Fi on for better location, you know, more accurate location data, is because when these cars, the Google and Apple and other cars, drive around taking the pictures and figuring out locations, they're also monitoring Wi-Fi signals and how strong a Wi-Fi signal is at any given point. Now, that includes your home Wi-Fi, if you can get it out if you're standing in the middle of the street, which if you live, you know, in a residential neighborhood, it's very possible, right? So that's, they've collected information about probably, you know, millions, certainly, Wi-Fi access points, those little networks you see when you go to connect, and figured out, you know, almost exactly where each one is based on the signals that they picked up when they were driving these cars around, which they do. They update them frequently as well. Then they are updating that information based on your phone. So they're updating it, you know, they got their initial bunch of data, and now they go in just based on what's on your phone. They're updating that and saying, okay, this new network is where this old one was. Maybe somebody moved into a new apartment, right? So we can replace that point of data with this one.
Why is Oracle involved in this? That was kind of at first confusing to me when I was reading through this article. Google and Oracle have a lot in common. Like you were saying, you know, both are enormous tech companies. Why are they sort of fighting, I guess, in this instance?
You know, interestingly enough, Google and Oracle don't have a good historical relationship. Oracle takes claim to the Java programming language that the Android operating system that Google uses on its phones are, you know, is based on. So basically, it's a patent lawsuit. This goes back to 2010. So this is related to that lawsuit. And the information is just trying to show that Google is a monopoly and they are violating, violating monopoly laws in addition to the copyright and patent claims that Oracle has been filed. This has been going on for nearly a decade now, and it's something like a $13 billion lawsuit in Australia.
Wow.
Wild. There's this other article you flagged for us. It's about a company in New Jersey who was also, you know, trying to monetize people's data, infringing on people's privacy. Only this time, the people who were targeted were minors.
Yeah. So I don't think either of you have heard of this company, ALC. I had certainly never heard of ALC, but we talked a few weeks ago, I believe, about a new Vermont law that required data brokers to register with the state. And there were 100 and something data brokers doing business in Vermont. They didn't necessarily have to be based in the state, but they were doing business there, meaning they were advertising there. And so this company said they had no knowledge of collecting any information on minors, people under the age of 18, but it turns out they were advertising lists of data of high school students. The vast majority of high school students are under 18. Some people graduate at 18, some people graduate at 17. And so it's clear that they were selling and collecting information on high school students, on people under the age of 18, even though they claimed in their filing with the state of Vermont that they absolutely were not. We're talking about 1.2 million student records. This article and the data dump show that it was the names, addresses, hobbies, high schools, interests, so much more. And you could get it relatively cheap, $100 for 1,000 records. Now, what those records do is they let you target those individuals, these students, these 14 to 17-year-olds, for advertising, for direct mail, for social media advertising, all of these things. It is absolutely an outrage that, first of all, this company was collecting this information in the first place, and then that they lied about it, and then that they were, sort of stupid enough to advertise the data they said they didn't have on their website, first of all. But this also goes to show why legislation only can go so far. Yes, it's illegal to do this, but they did it anyway because they got away with it. And, there could be a fine of $10,000, which, could just be basically a slap on the wrist for this company. They could get, there could be nothing, that they feel. They're going to probably count that in as a cost of doing business. Now, if they're getting 1.2 million records and, you get 1,000 of them for $100, I mean, you do the math and see they're going to make that money back immediately.
It's really remarkable. I mean, what protections, legally speaking, exist for minors online? Are there adequate protections to make sure that, I don't think that anybody should be subjected to this kind of surveillance, but I mean, it's kind of especially abhorrent when it's being done to people who are under 18.
Well, there are particular protections for children under 13 years old. That's often why you see that you have to verify that you are 13 years old or older when you go to sign up for a service, pretty much any service where you could have identifiable information, including an email address about you. Unfortunately, that doesn't extend to people 14 to 17. You can't, as a minor, agree to a contract. And then there's a legal question about, is a terms of service agreement a contract? But they can just get around that by saying you have to have your parents' permission to sign up for a service, right? Which, what 14-year-old is asking their parents' permission to sign up for Facebook would be the real question there. But, there are a few protections that have any teeth, we should say, for people between 13 and 17 years old.
And, what was the rationale for, that seems like pretty arbitrary.
The rationale for that goes back to, almost two decades is the COPPA Act, the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act. And part of it was to protect children from predators and other really like awful things online. But 13 was, seemed to be a very arbitrary cutoff. You're right.
Hey, tell us a little bit about facial recognition software. I've often wondered if the rest of us, common people can cut and paste a photograph in a Google search engine and have it tell us who this person is. I've never been able to make that work, but the cops apparently have been able to do it for many years. You've sent us an article entitled Facial Recognition's Dirty Little Secret, Millions of Online Photos Scraped Without Consent. What's that about?
Yeah, so facial recognition isn't just looking at a picture and saying, yeah, this is the same picture as that other picture of this person, therefore it's the same person, right? Facial recognition has advanced to the point that it can get you, even if you're a tiny little blip in the background of a photo. And you see this if you post a photo on Facebook, and draws those little squares on people and says, hey, tag your friends. It knows where the faces are. And for some people, it might even say, is this... I could post a photo of Walter and they'd say, is this Walter? But So facial recognition has come pretty far. The way that facial recognition, for the most part, works is by training algorithms to figure out how does a face look when it's smiling, when the eyes are closed, when there are glasses on it, and there are similarities, not just, you know, between an individual, but between multiple individuals, you know, what the changes to a face when you, you know, have a beard or don't have a beard, when you're wearing sunglasses or not, because then it can't see your eyes. And so they train these algorithms on just massive sets of photos. And one of the reasons they say they're doing this is because facial recognition AI technology has been historically awful at identifying people of color and women, because the training models have been primarily on photos of white people. The issue here is that they took a whole bunch of photos that were publicly available from a photo site called Flickr, which used to be a huge, you know, popular site for photographers. And no one really knew that they were using these photos. No one had consented directly to having these photos used to train facial recognition. They say that the license these photos were under was okay, and, you know, said it was okay to use this. But this goes to show we never know what our information is actually being used for. We put out a photo, you know, in the public domain for people to use it, you know, somewhere else. Use the take our photo, print it, enjoy it. But then IBM goes and grabs it and uses it for, you know, AI training.
We have just a couple of minutes left and we've got a lot more to talk about. But you know what? I feel bad, Chris, that we always short you when it comes to time to talk about the tech tip, right? Which is arguably the most important part of this segment. We've got about 2 minutes left. That ought to be enough to talk about Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, remind folks, if you are trying to get rid of Facebook and get Facebook out of your life, you also need to get rid of Instagram and you also need to get rid of WhatsApp. Facebook owns both of those companies now. They have made a public plan to integrate all of them so that your Facebook, your Instagram, your WhatsApp messaging are all combined, basically. This is just going to allow Facebook to gather more information on you, whether you want it to or not. Facebook already knows what you like. Instagram already knows what you like. I get stories on my Instagram saying, hey, you liked 3 photos that were about cats this week. So it knows, right? So if you're trying to get rid of Facebook out of your life, which not everyone is able to do, and that's perfectly understandable, you also need to kill Instagram and WhatsApp. And it could be enough to just remove the apps from your phone. That would get rid of WhatsApp for you entirely. But you can use Facebook via your web browser. And you can look at Instagram via your web browser. You just can't post to it. So everyone has to take their own steps and figure out what they need and what their threat model is, what they're concerned about. But for folks who are trying to get out of Facebook's sphere, then you do need to remember that Facebook owns WhatsApp and they own Instagram.
Okay, we're out of time. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Caraffa, and we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of the show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear us, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. Thank you.